Lecture 5, Prayer.
Hi, welcome back. We are now going to be looking at the second of Shimon the Righteous's tripod of what the world stands on. The first leg of the tripod was Torah. And so we talked about Talmud Torah, the study of Torah, last session. Now we're going to be talking about Avodah, which should properly be translated as worship or service. But we're really going to be talking about prayer and the development of prayer from the biblical period to the rabbinic period, looking at some modern reformulations of prayers in the 19th and 20th century as well. And in between, we'll talk about the rise of the prayer house or the synagogue. The reason why I said that prayer, that avodah, should really be translated as worship or service is because in the Bible, avodah is almost always referring to animal sacrifice, the animal sacrifices that happened either in the tabernacle, according to the first five books of the Bible, or later on in the temple in Jerusalem. But there is one verse in Deuteronomy that talks about the worship of the heart. So we're not talking about open heart surgery here. So the rabbis understand that worship of the heart must be talking about something other than animal sacrifice. Therefore, it's talking about prayer. So although there's that one portion of the Torah that talks, that seems to be referring to worship of the heart as opposed to sacrificial worship, generally in the Hebrew Bible, that term avodah refers to sacrificial worship. But that doesn't mean that the idea of prayer isn't widespread in the Torah. Indeed, it is. Very frequently in the Bible, we have prayer that involves a request or a petition. For instance, we have a motif throughout the Hebrew Bible of the women being barren and needing to pray to God in order to open up their womb. In the first instance that I'm going to mention, Isaac, who's married to Rebekah, sees that Rebekah is barren and pleads with God to open up his wife's womb, a nice thing for a husband to do. He steps up to the plate and prays to God for his wife. We also see that Moses prays for his sister Miriam when she is afflicted with some kind of strange disease, and he prays for her full healing. I don't want to give you the impression that only men in the Hebrew Bible pray. Hannah, in 1 Samuel, also prays. She's another barren woman to continue this motif, and she prays for a child, and she says that if she gets this child, she will dedicate it to the Lord, and Hannah's child actually becomes the first prophet, Samuel. Other prayers in the Hebrew Bible aren't specifically about petition, but they're about praising God and God's work. For instance, Psalm 92 begins, "It is good to praise the Lord, to sing hymns to your name, O Most High." So it's a song of celebration. Many of the Psalms originally were set to music, and they still have musical notations in them, like Selah. Selah is a popular word. It's also a not uncommon name for girls, usually. Not Stella, Selah. And the idea of the musical notation has been lost. We know that it had something to do with conducting the music, but we don't know exactly what Selah means. Other psalms are for individual worship, like, "Oh, I am in distress," or "Oh, it is good for me to praise you and your works, and the mountain should sing, and the hills should leap in order to acclaim God's greatness." Other psalms seem to clearly be communal, where it's the entire community, like Psalm 105, for instance, that is singing God's praises. There's also a series of psalms, Psalm 120 to 134, that begins with the superscription. It begins with the first few words, Shir Hama'alot, a song of ascents. Now, this is very interesting because what scholars speculate is that the Levites would stand on the steps of the temple, and there were 15 steps, and you have 15 psalms that begin with that superscription, a song of ascents. So they would stand on the steps, not exactly like the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, but sort of like the Israelite Temple Choir, and they would sing, and in many cases, the singing would be communal or antiphonal. So they would sing a verse, and then the congregants in the courtyard, the Israelites in the courtyard, would then sing back a refrain. And so we see this in, say, Psalm 136, where you've got different verses, and then the refrain is, for God's Ki le'olam chasdo, for God's mercy is everlasting. One of the interesting things about the rise of synagogues, synagogue is a Greek word that means a house of worship, or a house, not a house of worship, a house of assembly, house of gathering, is that we see the rise of the first synagogues already in Egypt in the 3rd century BCE. Now, these buildings seem to have been more prevalent in the diaspora outside of the land of Israel than inside the land of Israel until about the 3rd century. By the 3rd century, you have synagogues all over the land of Israel as well. The earliest synagogues were communal meeting houses in addition to prayer houses, so they filled all kinds of community needs. Now, this is important because as synagogues develop before the temple is destroyed, they're not necessarily challenging the exclusive centralization of worship in Jerusalem, at least those synagogues that we see in the land of Israel. Outside the land of Israel, you certainly have more prayers happening in the synagogues because they simply don't have the kind of convenient access to the temple in Jerusalem that the folks who are living in the land of Israel have. One of the things that's also interesting about the synagogues is that we have pretty good evidence that the Pharisees, who, as I said before, were the most popular of the sects of late Second Temple Judaism, weren't involved in the leadership of the synagogues. And then after the temple was destroyed, the rabbis also were not involved in the leadership of the early synagogues. Why do we know this? Because contemporary archaeologists in their digs in these sites, both in the land of Israel and outside the land of Israel, have found gorgeous mosaics of representational art in the synagogues, including depictions of biblical scenes like Abraham sacrificing his son Isaac, not quite sacrificing, but having the knife in his hand, as well as constellations and different kinds of astrological representations in the synagogue itself. We know that the Pharisees and the rabbis would have been uncomfortable with that because of their commitment to a rather strict interpretation of one of the commandments in the Decalogue, which prohibits representational art. So whoever was the leadership of these synagogues in the land of Israel and outside the land of Israel must have been at least strong enough to override that Pharisaic concern. One interesting note is that also the constructions of the synagogue don't suggest that there was any separate seating for women. And we have names of women who were actually leaders of their congregations. Now, we know from the Talmud that the rabbis had some problems with women leading services, although technically there isn't a problem, but on the practical level there would be some problems, and that has continued into Orthodoxy unto this day, where women don't participate in the leadership roles during the prayer service itself. But we find in the earliest synagogues that women, there certainly isn't a separate women's section, so one piece of speculation is that women might not have been there at all. I doubt that, but it's always a possibility. And certainly there were some women who were leaders within their own synagogue communities. As the temple is destroyed, what we have at Yavne, remember Yavne is where Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai was spirited out from the burning city of Jerusalem and he established that first academy at Yavne. What they did at Yavne was to create a kind of template of what each prayer service should contain. Up until that point, prayer was spontaneous and it was individual and it had to do with whatever spoke to the individual prayer at that moment, whether it was praise or whether it was petition or whether it was thanksgiving, right? After having done really well on an exam, you want to give thanks to the Lord because, after all, you had prayed to do really well in your petitionary prayer before you took the exam. So what the sages of Yavne did was to fix a general order for the central prayer, which is called the Amidah. The Amidah literally means standing up, and Jews say this prayer in a standing posture. And the first prayer book that we really know about comes at the earliest in the 8th century, probably the 9th century, of the Common Era. So what the prayer book has are not just a fixed order of the prayers, but actually fixed words for each blessing. In the Amidah, in that central prayer, there are 19 different blessings, and we'll talk about what some of those blessings are in just a moment. But at the very earliest stage of prayer development in Yavne, there wasn't that fixed formula for each blessing, but just a general sequence of how the prayers should unfold. Avodah, worship, had generally been performed through the sacrificial system during temple times, as I mentioned. But worship of the heart was interpreted by the rabbis to mean prayer. Now, the rabbis in the Talmud dispute whether or not the prayer services were instituted by the patriarchs or as a replacement to the now defunct sacrificial system, right? And they present arguments on both sides. Abraham instituted the morning service, and Isaac instituted the afternoon service, and Jacob instituted the evening service. And they say, the other side of the argument says, no. There's a morning service and an afternoon service that involved animal sacrifices, and prayer is just coming to substitute for that. Their conclusion is very interesting, because what they're not really arguing about history. The rabbis in the Talmud, right, they're not so plugged into history. That's not what motivates them. They're arguing about whether or not prayer is personal, individual, and spontaneous, right, coming from the patriarchs, or whether, like the sacrifices, they're communal and institutionalized. Their answer, in a way, is both, but they claim that prayer was originated by the patriarchs. So the ideal for prayer is to be personal, spontaneous, individual, but then it was institutionalized in order to correspond to the sacrifices in the temple as a memory, as a reminder of those sacrifices in the temple. So it's important as we move into the medieval period and the modern period to remember that the ideal kind of prayer for the rabbis was indeed coming from the prayer's heart rather than something that was found to be in a fixed text in the prayer book. Okay, if we open up the traditional Orthodox prayer book today that goes back to the 8th century, that first prayer book that we talked about, and those ideas themselves go back to the Talmud, one of the first things that we see in the morning service is a description of creation. And there is a repeated line that God daily renews creation. God daily renews creation. Now, if you think back to Genesis 1, Genesis 1 presents the creation of the world as a fait accompli. God created the world in 6 days. On the 7th day, God rested, and that was it. Creation was historical. But for the rabbis, for the poets of the liturgy, creation is ongoing. Because what the poet is trying to get the prayer to buy into is this idea that God's providence and activity in the world is not merely historical, but it's ongoing. And so by saying that God daily renews creation, we're supposed to see the sun rising in the morning and reflect on God's creation of the sun at that moment in order to feel closer to God's activity on a daily basis. There's another section of the morning prayer service that alludes to Isaiah chapter 45, verse 7. The liturgist takes that verse and tweaks it a little bit. What the verse actually says is that God forms light and creates darkness, makes peace and creates evil. Creates evil. Now, why would 2 Isaiah say this, right? There are two or three different people's books that went into Isaiah. Isaiah was writing, the second Isaiah, Deutero-Isaiah, was writing during the Babylonian exile when the Jewish community in Babylonia was coming into contact for the first time with these dualistic myths of a God of good and a God of evil. And so this later stage of Jewish development understands that, no, there's only one God for everything. And this God creates the good stuff, our God, creates the good stuff and creates the bad stuff. This now we see we are moving into a kind of universal monotheism, unlike the henotheism or monolatry that we discussed several lectures ago. So that verse is taken by the poet of the liturgy, and it is slightly adjusted to not emphasize the evilness, but to emphasize God's creation of the light. So the way that prayer service adopts the line is God forms light and creates darkness, makes peace and creates everything. They change the word evil to everything so that you don't have to dwell on the negative. But again, it's this idea that God is continually making light. It's not something that happened in the remote past. Now, in the Hebrew Bible, as well as in the liturgy, there are polemics against other religious systems. And we see this in the evening service as well. The evening service says that God arranges the stars in their heavenly rotations according to his will. Okay. So it's nighttime when you say the evening service. You see the stars, and God arranges them all according to the divine will. What is this a polemic against? Babylonian astrology. The Babylonians understood that the stars were gods and they controlled our fate. So the rabbis in the Talmud were willing to say, okay, maybe the stars do control your fate. But who controls the stars? God controls the stars. You also see this in the opening chapter of Genesis, where you have light created on day one, and the sun isn't created until day four. Well, for the Babylonians, the sun was a god. But when the creation story gets reworked in its Jewish version or its Israelite version, the sun is just another one of God's creations, and indeed our God can create light even without a sun. So you see these subtle, or not so subtle at the time, polemics against other religious systems and religious ideologies. Okay, let's move into the central prayer that Jews say three times a day in the morning service, the afternoon service, and the evening service. We're going to focus specifically on the daily Amidah, that daily central prayer, as opposed to the other Amidot, plural for Amidahs, the plural for Amidah, that are recited either on the Sabbath or on holidays. So the prayer begins, the Amidah begins by praising God. It's a good way to butter somebody up before you ask for a series of requests, and invoking the notion of the merit of our ancestors. Now, if you remember Tom Wolfe's book, Bonfire of the Vanities, he had something called a favor bank. So that if I do somebody a favor in 1980, I can wait even until the year 2000 to cash in my favor, and that person owes me one. Well, what the merit of our fathers does is to make that intergenerational. Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and in the modern movements of reform and conservative and reconstructionism, we say, and their wives, Sarah, Rebecca, Leah, and Rachel, they did such great things. They were such righteous people. God, you owe them one. Oh, but you know what? They're not around. So we're their descendants, so we'll be happy to take the payback ourselves. Right? It's an intergenerational favor bank. The second blessing in the Amidah praises God's power and includes the power to resurrect the dead. Remember, that's something that distinguished the Pharisees from the Sadducees, and we'll have a session coming up on the world to come and resurrection of the dead, but it becomes a central component of rabbinic Judaism, even though it's a late and marginal idea within the Hebrew Bible itself. The third blessing of the Amidah has Israel imitating the angelic choir and coronating God as king. Right? This is what we can do for God. We can coronate God because there is no king without a people. Right? You can't be a king of a kingdom if your kingdom has no population. So we're willing to recognize, we're happy to recognize, we sing in joy to recognize God as our king, and then we go into the petitionary requests. The middle section of the Daily Amidah contains the petitions, which some scholars understand to be a roadmap to redemption. The very first petitionary prayer begins with a request for the wisdom to know, the wisdom for knowledge. Right? It might be part of this intellectual elitism that promotes Talmud Torah over all other commandments, but more likely, it's a request to know God's will. Because changing our ways to reflect God's will then prompt God to forgive our past transgressions, and redemption will naturally ensue. And those indeed are the subsequent blessings. What redemption will then look like is outlined in the remaining blessings. Pain and suffering will cease, economic prosperity will prevail, and there will be an ingathering of the exiles to the land of Israel. Justice will flow like a mighty river, with punishment meted out to heretics and reward for the righteous. Jerusalem and the temple will be rebuilt. And finally, the icing on the cake is that the Messiah will come. The concluding blessings of this section serve as an exclamation point asking God to hear our prayers. That's actually the concluding blessing of that middle petitionary section. It's important, and we'll come back to this idea, that all the work of this roadmap to redemption happens, all the work happens before we ask for the Messiah to come. Right? So the Messiah culminates the process of redemption rather than initiates the process of redemption. And that's very important to understand the psychology of rabbinic Judaism. Now, redemption involves Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel. So the role of the Messiah is relegated to the end of that process. All the work has been done prior to his appearance. And that reflects the rabbinic discomfort with messianic speculation, because the rabbis are creating the sequence of these blessings where? In Yavne, after the destruction of the Second Temple. And probably the final sequence doesn't happen until after the failed Bar Kokhba revolt. And so the rabbis were burned on messianic speculation, because every time they think that they're about to regain political sovereignty from Rome, it turns out very, very bad for them. So they retain the idea of the Messiah, but they relegate it to the distant future, to the very end of the process of redemption, to try to quash contemporary messianic speculation and not get into trouble in the future like they had in their very recent past. The final three blessings of all of the Amidahs serve as a conclusion, asking God to accept our prayer and thanking God for the miracles that are daily with us. That's actually my favorite blessing of the Amidah, because miracles are understood by the rabbis not only to be those supernatural occurrences of the parting of the Red Sea and the plagues and all the other lights and bells and whistles that we see in the Hebrew Bible, but the sun coming up and lightning and the formation of mountains, all of those things that are daily with us, they're also evidence of God's providential activity in this world, and they're considered by the rabbis to be miracles as well. The final blessing, of course, has to be beseeching God to bless us with peace. Peace is the ultimate hallmark of redemption. As we jump 1,500 years, there are certain modern reformulations of the traditional prayer that I want to mention here. The reform movement that begins in the early 19th century, say by 1818, you have the beginnings of the reform movement in Germany, they rejected the idea of the resurrection of the dead. And specifically in their 1885 Pittsburgh platform, when they got here to the United States, they said that the immortality of the soul, that's fine, we totally buy that. But they rejected the idea of a resurrection of the dead as not being Jewish in origin, and they really thought that it was not in keeping with modern sensibilities to talk about this kind of zombie action of folks being resurrected from the dead. So they changed that word dead in most of their prayers to God creates all life, the quickening of all life. So God enlivens everything, not just resurrecting the dead, not just giving life to the dead. Also, Reformed prayer books, in a way that is very much in keeping with the flow of the sequence of the blessings, they reject the idea of an individual Messiah. So no longer for the Reform movement is the Messiah going to be a male. That's not egalitarian, right? It's not gender inclusive. Nor will the Messiah necessarily be from the Davidic line. That's also about your pedigree rather than about your personal status. And so just like the blessings, the sequence of the blessings in the traditional prayer build up to a messianic era that the Messiah just caps off, well, what the Reform movement does is they cap off the Messiah, right, and bracket him. Once you've got the messianic era, that's all the Reform movement is looking for. So they change, they're sensitive to the Hebrew, although there's far less Hebrew in traditional, in classic Reform services than in traditional services, but they change the word redeemer to redemption, or they change the word in Hebrew goel to geulah, right? A subtle change, but it gets at a theological conviction. Reform and conservative prayer books have generally been uncomfortable with praying for the reestablishment of animal sacrifices. In the traditional prayer book, you pray to rebuild the temple and the fires of Israel. Well, those fires of Israel refer to the fires of the animal sacrifices. So even in the conservative movement, which is far more conservative with a small c, than Reform or Reconstruction or the Reconstructionist movements, they've been uncomfortable, and so they've modified the language to talk about the animal sacrifices in the past, and that it's not necessarily going to be resurrected or it's not going to be continued in the future. So the temple may very well be rebuilt, but there'll be different ways of worshiping than had been the case in the past. Among the many reforms that the Reconstructionists have made, and in this case, Reform and Conservative Judaism as well, is to make the liturgy more gender inclusive, as I mentioned. So, in general, when the patriarchs are mentioned, the matriarchs are also invoked. A further modification that Reconstructionist Judaism has made in its prayer book, Kol HaNeshama, is to not exclusively refer to God in the male gender. So very frequently, and it's somewhat unsettling for the traditional prayer that's not used to this kind of language, but it doesn't take you so long to get used to either, God is referred to as the source of all being or as the womb of all life. And then the pronoun, because Hebrew requires gendered pronouns, Hebrew doesn't have the neutered pronoun it the way English does. So God is referred to in the feminine. And again, that's something that is very modern, very new, and has not crossed the denominational lines into mainstream Reform or mainstream conservative Judaism. I want to finish the lecture with a quote from the Talmud that gets at perhaps a justification for liturgical modification. A prayer that doesn't innovate is not a prayer of supplication. Now, the rabbis and the halakha, Jewish law, they have problems with changing the fixed text of the blessings. But we also see a voice that says, look, if there's no innovation, if it doesn't mean something new or say something new, then it's not a genuine prayer of supplication. And so perhaps this is the motivation for contemporary denominations within Judaism to experiment with new forms of the liturgy. Okay, so we will next examine the third leg of Shimon the Righteous's tripod of what the world stands on, deeds of loving kindness.